Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Phil Shook, and he'll be answering your questions on surf, sand, and silver, fly fishing the Padre Island National Seashore. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Phil a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill out the form on the right side of our homepage, and we'll let you know when the next live show will be. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website about 48 hours after the show ends. You can also find it on any of the podcast sites like Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pocket Casts, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website or any of the podcast platforms at your convenience and listen to the recording at any time. If you're out and about on Facebook, Instagram, or X, we'd sure appreciate it if you'd share our podcast. And when you do, use the hashtag AskAboutFlyFishing and hashtag FlyFishing. In fact, if you have a moment, do it right now and share this great shows that we have to offer. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. When we return, we'll be talking with Phil Shook about fly fishing the Padre Island National Seashore. Watermaster is dedicated to providing their customers with the highest quality inflatables on the market, as well as unbeatable customer service and product support. They are the best known for their signature products, the Watermaster Grizzly, Kodiak, and Bruin rafts. These rafts are lightweight, compact, durable, versatile, and safe. The Watermaster rafts are everything your personal watercraft should be. They have been used by anglers and hunters all over the world. Visit Watermaster today and take a look at the ultimate personal flotation craft. Go to BigSkyInflatables.com. Again, that's BigSkyInflatables.com. Before we introduce Phil, we'd like to let you know about the great prizes we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International and a one-year membership to Trout Unlimited. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under tonight's section that says Register for a Free Drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a book courtesy of Stackpole Books. I have a whole bunch of books here from Stackpole that I'm able to give away. So the winner will be able to choose from a list that I provide. So here's how you can win one of Stackpole's books. You've got to be the first person to answer the question I ask at the end of the show. The question will be about something we talked about during the show. You must submit your answer along with your name and location using that text box on our homepage, and first person that gets it correct wins. And so listen closely, take good notes, pay attention, type fast, and when the time comes, maybe you'll be the proud winner of a Stackpole book. Tonight, our guest is Phil Shook. Phil is a Texas native and nationally known fly fishing writer and instructor. He first traveled to Mexico as a boy with his family in the 1950s. He recalls the thrill of seeing flights of parrots overhead as his family made its way down a jungle road and across a remote river to a beach hotel at San Blas on the Pacific coast. A few years later, at the age of 15, he made another long drive trip into Mexico with his father in a 1956 Chevy Camaro carrier pickup. This time they took along a Peñon skiff in the truck bed so they could sample the fishing at a number of coastal stops from Guaymas to Mazatlan. Phil's angling and travel stories have appeared in Field and Stream, Outdoor Life, Fly Fishing in Salt Waters, Fly Tire, Fly Rod and Reel, American Angler, Fly Fisherman, Saltwater Sportsman, and other magazines. He's the author of four fly fishing guidebooks, including his recent Fly Fishing Guide to Mexico. His outdoor writing and angling travel assignments have taken him from Cape Cod to Cabo San Lucas, Mexico, and from Hudson Bay to Manitoba to Caracas, Venezuela. He's also the author of Fly Fisher's Guide to the Northeast Coast, Fly Fisher's Guide to Texas, and co-author of Fly Fishing Texas Coast Backcountry Flats to Blue Water. He has received the Arnold Gingrich Memorial Award and Silver King Award from the International Federation of Fly Fishers for contributions to the literature of fly fishing. He is a member of the Outdoor Writers Association of America and a past director of the Texas Outdoor Writers Association and the Southeast Outdoor Press Association. He's an active volunteer with Project Healing Waters. And welcome back, Bill, to Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thank you, Roger.
Good to have you back again. And just before the show, Phil and I were kind of on opposite ends of the spectrum. He's down in southern Texas, and I'm in the mountains of Colorado, and it's, what did I say? It was 16 degrees here, Phil? Something like
yeah.
that. I don't know what the temperature is where you are, but we've got our first winter freeze going on here.
It's getting cool here, but not that
cool. Not like that, yeah. And still you can go down to the beach and fish, right? So
there you go.
Yeah. So that's what we're going to talk about tonight and have lots of fun doing that. So I hope you guys are ready. And again, if you have any questions, shoot them in that form on our homepage and we'll try to get them answered tonight on the show. Let me just do one thing here. Check. Okay. All right. We're ready to go. Okay. So talking about Padre Island National Seashore. So first of all, where in the world is the Padre Island National Seashore and what does it offer fly fishers and other visitors?
Great question, Roger. And I will put that on the map for us tonight. But first, I would like to mention at the start that as a native of San Antonio, I was lucky to grow up spending my summers exploring these Texas barrier islands, San Jose, Mustang, Padre Island. And even with the increase in visitors over the years, they have retained their sense of the wild. With the roar of the breaking surf and the great numbers of fish, the variety of species, birds and animals that move through there during the annual migrations along this stretch of coast, it's a sight to see and an adventure waiting to happen for fly fishers. In more recent years, these barrier island beachfronts have opened up a whole new world of action for us, for fly fishers. This is a place where at the end of the day, after a round-trip fly fishing safari, one literally can be worn out from catching fish. So where is the Padre Island National Seashore? Padre Island National Seashore is located near Corpus Christi, Texas. It's on a 113-mile-long island along the Gulf Coast. It's the largest undeveloped barrier island in the world. Visitors are allowed to drive vehicles and fish along 65 miles of beachfront that runs southward to the East Cut. It's a man-made pass at the community of Port Mansfield. To aid beach travel and rescue operations, large markers indicate cumulative mileage at 5-mile intervals. There's also a visitor center near the entrance with a gift shop, snacks, free showers, observation towers, a boardwalk to the stretch of beach for swimmers. There's also a nearby access to the famous Laguna Madre estuary. A boat ramp and windsurfing center also are there. Entry fees for the park are $15 to $25, depending on the length of the stay. So, Roger, I know is interested in hearing a little bit about the human history of the island. Isn't that right, Roger?
Yeah. I'd love to hear that.
So,
yeah.
Most of Padre Island has remained in its primitive state since humans first set foot on it. The semi-arid lands of the Texas coastal bend were never inhabited by the Comanches or other Plains Indians. Instead, other small tribes of Indians maintain a subsistence off the coastal shores by hunting and gathering food. One of those groups were the Caracuas, the cannibal giants of America who were the island's first surf fishermen. In 1554, three Spanish galleons en route from Veracruz, Mexico to Cuba were caught in a storm and ran aground on Padre Island. With 384 Spanish aristocrats aboard and holds full of New World plunder. They were met by these tall, indigenous, heavily tattooed people who at first befriended them, then they shot several of the Spaniards full of arrows, cooked and ate them.
Oh,
only a few Spaniards survived the ordeal, eventually making their way barefoot over the harsh South Texas brush country to a settlement in Mexico. A day on the beach can be, or camping out there can get tough. It's sandy and wind blowing, but nothing as bad as what those Spaniards ran into, I'll tell you that. So how did fly fishers first find out about the great fishing on this beach? From my perspective, about 25 or 30 years ago, a handful of Houston fly fishers began having conversations with Billy Sandifer, the late Padre Island beach guy, who had a booth every year at the big Houston fishing show. That developing relationship would open an exciting new frontier for a small but dedicated group of fly fishers for years to come. Sandifer was a colorful individual. He grew up on a farm about 50 miles west of Padre Island. After stints as a CB in Vietnam, a federal sky marshal working out of Queens, New York, a Gulf shrimp boat crewman, and a bouncer at a biker bar, the free-spirited Sandifer sought an escape from the civilized world, and Padre Island was the perfect match for him. His uniform for the day at work was like Captain Jack Sparrow in a Johnny Depp pirate film. He wore a snappy straw hat, shorts, and a long sleeve shirt open down the middle and a set of snake rattles braided into his ponytail. He was one of the first to introduce angling safaris by van down the entire national seashore. His initial clients were light tackle anglers who fished for trout and redfish on the seashore with artificial lures. He also took shark fishermen down the beach. And in 1990, one of his clients landed an 870-pound tiger shark that was the largest shark caught on rod and reel in the Western Gulf at that time. In more recent years, members of fly fishing clubs in Houston and San Antonio have made annual fishing and camping trips to the National Seashore. They welcome guests, and this is a very good way to learn how to navigate the beach and take part and the fly fishing adventure that it offers. Sandifer got to know these fly fisher clients well, and he embraced the game. In later years, he became a skilled fly fisher himself. Sandifer, who died in 2018 at 70, was recognized nationally for his work in organizing beach cleanups on the National Seashore. The Padre Seashore has a trash and plastic problem that Sandifer worked to address. The reasons that the beach cleanups led over the years by Sandifer and now others are so important is that the Padre Seashore has a big trash and plastic problem through no direct fault of its own. The island is one of the most pristine and remote beaches that one can find, but its location is in the direct path of ocean currents that bring everything that is thrown into or emptied into the entire Gulf of Mexico to its beaches. With more than 65 miles of shoreline, the Padre Seashore staff depends on the support of volunteer groups from the general public to help with the cleanups. The cleanup effort has grown to more than 1,000 volunteers who pick up some 50 tons of trash along the sand dunes annually. Sandifer organized and led these cleanups for about 14 years. For his efforts, he received a number of awards, Conservation and Environmental Stewardship Award from the Coastal Bend Bays Foundation, and he was a finalist for Field and Stream Magazine's Heroes of Conservation Award. Local officials have recognized the contributions that Sandifer made by naming a Padre Island access road in his name. Jeff Wolda of Padre Island Light Tackle Adventures, a younger generation full-time beach guide, worked with Sandifer for years and earned his respect. Wolda, a Navy veteran, is also active in conservation efforts on the seashore and serves as vice president of Friends of Padre, which continues to sponsor the annual beach cleanups. So that's a little background on how all of this got started for fly fishermen, and we owe a lot to Billy Sandifer.
Yeah, I would say so. A few questions, kind of circling back here. When you said there's a road on the island from one end to the other, or at least, what did you say, 60-some miles, I think it was? Is that road, I mean, can you drive a normal car down it? Do you need an SUV? Do you need, a dune buggy?
That is a very good question because this is a road that changes constantly and you with Mother Nature, but it is the beach. And so, yes, there are certain requirements. After the first 5 miles, four-wheel drive is required. And you have to be very savvy about the conditions. So high tides will pretty much shut the beach down. There's soft sand, there's mixed shells. So you have to be pretty savvy. People learn how to drive this beach. It comes with experience. And that's why it's a good idea to go with a club or go with a guide in your initial visits there. I rented a SUV one time, and I didn't get past the entrance off the park road onto the beach. I got stuck right there. That's kind of embarrassing when that happens, but I've learned since then to go with some experienced beach drivers. But it can be
Huh.
done fairly easily.
Yeah.
So
Okay. Yeah, it
go ahead.
the other question is you had mentioned multiple fees for access and so forth. Can you actually camp on the beach? Are there designated campgrounds? Is it dispersed camping? What's that look like?
Yes, there's a little bit, several options. There's a camping area that you can right at the entrance, and there's also camping is allowed for a certain period of time on the beach. Fly fishing clubs usually have like a weekend, Friday through Sunday trip, and you can cover a lot of ground and have quite an adventure that way. There are some restrictions on living. I think you can stay for like 28 days and then you have to take a break from it, but there's certainly some camping opportunities for longer periods of time.
Are they developed campgrounds? In other words, hookups for water and electric,
Yes,
or?
in the entry area there is a developed campground, but you're on your own on the beach.
Okay. And if you weren't going to be camping out, where is the nearest city or town that you would recommend staying at, for lodging?
Okay, right. Well, usually people that fish there for a day, they're usually down there in that area, and you have many different options. It's a very popular destination for tourists year-round. Corpus Christi and the communities of Rockport, Port Aransas, Aransas Pass are very popular areas for beachgoers. So they're close by. You have a civilization, but once you hit the seashore, it's only there at the visitor center where you have, they have showers and as I mentioned, but outside of that, you're on your own for 65 miles. There's not much in the way of convenience stores on the beach.
No restaurants, nothing developed, like you said,
The
right? Yeah.
restaurants, if you catch a like a fresh Spanish mackerel, and you take it back to Port Aransas that evening to one of the You Hook 'em, We Cook 'em restaurants, you will have a
Ah.
very delicious entree.
So where do you, is there only one entrance onto the island? And what's the first thing that visitors see when they leave the
Good. Yeah.
pavement and enter the beach drive there?
A good question. Greeting fly fishers making the early morning runs down the seashore are usually large arrays of gulls and terns that line up along the water's edge in anticipation of the breakfast feeding frenzy. Black skimmers with their bright red bills begin those low-flying strafing runs over the swash zone. Brown pelicans cruise in formation, wingtips inches above the water's edge. There's something for everyone, for beachgoers, shell collectors, birders, and naturalists, as well as for us anglers. The sense of a wild marine wilderness and the sound of the wind and pounding surf will envelop you entering the beach. There are 380 species of birds on the seashore, including occasional sightings of rarer visitors such as piping plovers, peregrine falcons, ophidlemato falcons, and parasitic jaegers. The migrating lease terns and black terns can number in the tens of thousands. I've been on trips there in the fall when you're moving down through clouds of terns opening up in front of your van, and then they close up behind you. Coyotes, white-tailed deer, kangaroo rats, raccoons, western diamondback rattlesnakes also live on the island. And you're looking at uniform sets of breaking waves stretching for miles, and these are broken up occasionally by holes and washouts carved out by storms, shifting winds and currents. And these are the features that you look for to find some of the game fish waiting to ambush the movements of the forage fish.
Are there beaches for people to actually swim? Is it comfortable to swim?
Yes, there's hundreds of thousands of people visit the seashore each year, but I would say that most of the swimmers and beachgoers either will visit right in front of the visitor center or the first 5 miles of the seashore. That's where you will see the most people during the summer months and some of the during the vacation season. As you get further down, you'll see fewer and fewer people, serious anglers, fly fishers, birders, the serious people. But yes, it's a very attractive beach that draws thousands of people each year.
So it's just like everywhere else we go fishing in the world. All you have to do is go about a mile from the from the pullout, and you start losing people, right?
Exactly. Taking that trailhead there out west where you live.
Yeah, yeah. Seems that way in a lot of places. I got to take a break. Let me take a quick break, and then when we come back, and we're going to dig into the type of fish that we can catch there. So
great.
Hang tight, and I'll be back in just a moment. The Ugly Bug Fly Shop in Casper, Wyoming, has been serving fly fishers in Wyoming and around the world since 1983. Their selection of top-of-the-line gear and a huge assortment of flies is one of the best in the land. All products are available in their fly shop and online. We're looking for advice, just give them a call, and their expert professional staff will help you with whatever you need. Visit Ugly Bug Fly Shop today at uglybugflyshop.com or call them at 866-845-9284. Again, that's the uglybugflyshop.com or call them at 866-845-9284. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Phil Shook about fly fishing the Padre Island National Seashore. If you'd like to ask Phil a question, just go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com, and fill out that Q&A text box and send us your question. So, Phil, I always take a break here and ask my guests, what's going on in your fly fishing world right now? Tell us what's happening.
Okay, well, a few weeks ago, I did make another trip down to the seashore and fished with Jeff Wolda, who I mentioned, and we had a terrific trip that was unusually calm surf condition. There was water quality was like the Bahamas, and we had a very good day. We sighted some redfish in some of the holes right next to the beach. We had some excitement with Jack Crevel, who sometimes just show up unexpectedly running through the backlit in the waves. So we had action with them. We caught some speckled trout, spotted sea trout, and just had a very good day, and that was in October, which is a prime month to go down there. So I also had a recent trip to the Bahamas, to Andros Island, with a big group of fly fishers here from Houston, and we had, if we could just be in three or four places at the same time in the fall, in November, I think we would have more stories to tell about our fishing trips.
Yeah, I bet. Any new books on your writing table?
I have a few book ideas that just kind of keep you busy, but I haven't quite plunged into it yet. I'm writing a few feature stories occasionally. Just did one on the Panga, the boat that kind of changed the history of marine history in Mexico, a boat that I have going on at both on the Pacific and on the flats. And so I try to stay busy with writing.
Has that been published yet?
Yes. It is in On the Fly magazine, the current issue of On the Fly magazine. It's a story about pongas and fishing on the Pacific coast of Mexico and in Yucatan.
Yeah.
Out of the Panga.
Yeah, I've been on many of those. Yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah.
They're the workhorses.
Well, thanks for sharing, and let's talk about the game fish that
the
you
fish,
would find
yes.
on National Seashore there.
We'll talk about the fish. We've gotten to the fish. So under favorable wind and sea conditions, there are a few destinations I see that offer more fishing action in a given day from such a variety of species. Short casts, only a few steps from the beach, often are the order of the day. And while redfish and spotted sea trout are the most popular targets, ladyfish, jacques-creval, pompano, palometa, Spanish mackerel, tarpon, king mackerel, little tunny, whiting, and snook are also caught by fly fishers over the course of the year on the national seashore. Spotted sea trout are one of the most popular targets for fly fishers, spin and plug fishermen. Speckled trout are found the length of the island, especially when the longshore currents bring clear green water to the edge of the beach. Those highly prized 28 to 30-inch fish, the solitary females, sometimes are spotted feeding in the waders' guts in deeper holes carved out right next to the beach. A stealthy approach on foot and an accurate cast with a small fly on a long leader is required for these fish. Redfish pop up about any time running the surf in schools. They also are targeted around any structure, including remnants of sunken shrimp boats. Acre-sized schools of ladyfish, joined by Spanish mackerel, jacks, little tunny, create the most visible shows with their aggressive surface feeding. They also are magnets for drawing diving terns and gulls that can be spotted in the distance. The beach guides and seasoned surf fishing hands spend a lot of time inspecting these big schools of ladyfish, or skipjacks as we call them in Texas, to see if other game fish are hanging out with them, feeding along the edges of these big schools in their feeding frenzies. And the only way you can be sure is only ladyfish is by wading out in the surf and looking. Sometimes jacques-creval, tarpon, are right in with the ladyfish in 3 or 4 feet of water. Spanish mackerel, bluefish, pompano, palometa, and whiting are also caught around these feeding free-for-alls. Tarpon, the large tarpon, are spotted during their prime summer through fall migrations, traveling beyond the breaker lines with a smaller juvie tarpon, sometimes closer in within range of fly cast. And, of course, these migrations in the fall coincide with similar migrations of bay anchovies, the forage fish, bay anchovies that are called rain minnows, dusky anchovies, finger mullet. It just sets off the whole show in the fall. The whole basket of game fish with snook added to the mix often will congregate around the East Cut Pass at the end of the beach drive. We probably want to say a little bit about sharks. Sharks are a subject that will always come up on a trip down the seashore, especially for those of us who like to wade a bit into the nearshore surf. There are plenty of monster sharks in the Gulf waters off the Texas Barrier Islands. As Sandifer used to say, when you're wading out on the third bar, you become an integral part of the food chain. Fortunately, there's no need to wade out that far. Shark fishing is a popular pastime on the Padre Seashore, and monsters are caught there every season. The seashore draws some of the most experienced shark fishermen on the planet, and many are equipped with kayaks to take baits out and towers on their vans from which they fight the giants. There also is an annual weekend sharkathon tournament there in the fall. They just finished that one there. But in my 35 years of fishing the seashore, I have never seen a big shark up close and personal that wasn't connected to an angler's line. It is a big event on the National Seashore to land a big shark, and great care is taken to release them unharmed. Often, anglers coming on the scene will help in the release. While bull sharks, lemon sharks, tigers, and hammerheads are at home in these waters, fly fishers are much more likely to encounter the sporty black-tip sharks.
Now, are you guys, when you say people are fishing for these, are they fly fishing or is this
No, these
heavy
are big game
stuff.
Shark fishermen that have been, that were clients for Billy Sander for years before the light tackle and fly fishing became more popular on the beach. But as I mentioned, Billy Sander caught that back in the early 90s, caught that huge shark.
Have you done any fishing on the fly for sharks?
Actually, I was going to mention that when I talk about examples of fishing action there over the years, because one safari, I remember standing in a group of about a half dozen 3-foot-long black tips milling around and feeding on small bait fish in a little wader's gut a few steps from the beach. I will never forget standing there listening to the roar of the surf, watching them carve out circles and trying to get just one of them to hit my streamer fly. It was like they were closing their eyes and just opening their mouth to pick up the bait fish that were filling the surf, and I couldn't get their attention, but it was a very memorable event for me there on the beach.
Yeah, cool. Question from Jason Stacy in Kentucky says, is the area easy to wade, or do you need a boat to really fish it? Or are both done, I would add.
This is really a beach fishing scenario. It's very accessible in the swash zone and in the first few steps in the beach. So really a boat, I think you technically can launch a boat from the beach, but only usually see shark fishermen do that, kayaks and things, to get their baits out for the big shark. This is really a vehicle. This is really a scouting safari trip out of a vehicle, and the wade fishing is really in depths of water that really are about knee deep to thigh deep at the deepest. Now, of course, you have breaking waves, which, you know, you're going to get soaked, but it's really a walk-in type adventure.
Is when you say you're going to get wet, is the water warm enough to just wet wade this?
Yeah, even on those cool mornings, with exception of the winter months, if you're out there wading in a blue norther, you rarely see people not wet wading. Of course, in the summer months, scorching summer months, it's kind of a relief. But, yeah there's a little bit early morning, and we're camping there. There's a little bit of a shock, and then you get over it. It's very warm water. 70 degrees plus is when the game fish become active in the spring, so that is not a problem, but you will get soaked, so wear those quick drying kind of flats wear is Deborah Gear there on the beach.
Phil McCartney wrote in here on the internet a question, and he's asking too about, can someone easily launch a canoe or kayak and fish from it along the coastal shore? Do you see much of that happening? Fishing, you know,
No, that's a good question. I would think that is not practical on the beach. However, in the seashore, you have access to the Laguna Madre within, and there's a launch ramp there for skiffs, shallow water skiffs that fish the famous Laguna Madre, and that's a very good area to launch kayaks and fish the fish the area around the launch ramp. There's a windsurfing center there, and if you're into windsurfing and fly fishing, you will always find a good day, because when it's flat calm, the fly fishers are out there in their kayaks, and when it's blowing 30 knots, the windsurfers are out there and the fly fishers are out of luck. But you can launch skiffs and kayaks within the seashore on a road that leads to the other side of the barrier island on the Laguna Madre.
So what kind of fishing is on within the Laguna Madre? I'm looking at it on the map, and it's quite extensive.
Yeah,
you know,
that
there's Baffin Bay, there's, yeah, all kinds of...
That is really the trademark fishing that has really put the Middle Texas coast on the map. It is sight casting to redfish from shallow water skiffs, and you have that opportunity at all those communities I mentioned, from Rockport and Port Aransas. The bay systems there are San Antonio Bay, Matagorda Bay, Aransas Bay, Redfish Bay, Corpus Christi Bay, and the Laguna Madre, that northern end, are famous for shallow water sight casting to redfish. There's some excellent guides down there that specialize in that. You can walk in and do that many areas. And so that's another option that is always there along with the beach adventure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sounds like you could spend a month down there.
Yeah, well, a whole lifetime.
A whole
lifetime. I think so.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, tell us about, you know, the prime seasons and conditions down there.
Yeah, okay. So I have had good trips year-round on the Padre beachfront, but I agree with Jeff Wolda, the veteran beach guide, on the best times to plan a trip. All anglers should put the fall months at the top of the list because of the big migrations of bait fish that draw in so many game fish, as well as bring the shorebirds that signal the presence of the game fish. Wolda says September and October are the best months for fly fishers. The dusky anchovies draw ladyfish, Spanish mackerel, redfish, speckled trout, small jacks, king mackerel close to the beach during this period. It sounds like I'm mentioning the same cast of characters of species over and over, but one big red can make the day. A 4 or 5 pound ladyfish will make a real scream, and everyone wants to catch a big jack. So that time of year, you have a chance to have a lot of action and maybe catch that fish of the season. I'll summarize the other months here. We've got to cover a lot of ground. Late September, the mullet run starts up and continues into November. I just witnessed that this last October, and it's a sight to see, this mullet migration. Schools of larger mullet can be seen out on the breaker line, and the smaller finger mullet fill the shallow surf zone. At first, it looks just like just a large school going by until one realizes it's a continuous wall of fish that stretches for miles and continues for hours. It's really something to see. It's like the wildebeest, you know, in the plains of Africa. The numbers of redfish in the surf also pick up dramatically in late September through November. Jack Crevel start running the surf in mid to late November. Fly fishing clubs try to time their weekend outings with this happening because, as I've said, everybody wants to land that 25-pound jack on a fly rod. Late November and December, strong cold fronts can shut the fishing down, but you get lucky on that sunny day. It can be great to be there. There's good action with redfish and jacks with a few trout around. January and February, slow periods, as you might imagine, for fishing on the beach, but warm spells and a flat surf will bring out pompano anglers who they like to walk out and fish from the first bar. There are trout around, but they are a bit lethargic. The retrieve has to be slow and then slower to draw a strike. March through May is called by the guides there the 3 at 30 period, 3 months of 30 mile per hour winds. This is a good time to be a windsurfer. But of course, if you time the trip with days that have calm winds, the fishing can be excellent during the spring also. Wolda considers June one of the best months to fish the surf for his light tackle and fly anglers, especially for speckled trout and redfish. Jacks also turn up at any time. And to finish it up, July and August, it's plenty hot, scorching summer days, but the trout action can be hot then too with redfish mixed in. So that covers the season.
Yeah.
You get lucky, you can have a good day pretty much year round there.
Yeah, yeah. Need to take another quick break here, Phil. So if you'll hang tight with me, I'll be right back and we'll talk more about strategies and tactics and stuff for fishing. So be right back. Discover the power of pure Skagit with Olympic Peninsula Skagit Tactics. From delicate soft tackles to hefty steelhead flies, OPST's versatile casting system meets the demands of every angling situation. With Ed Ward's unparalleled Skagit rod design and casting expertise, OPST offers you a quicker route to mastering effective casting techniques. Whether battling wind and rain or targeting steelhead, trout, or smallmouth bass, trust OPST's innovative rods, lines, and tips to elevate your fishing experience. Join the ranks of skilled anglers who rely on OPST for consistency, proficiency, and a superior fly fishing adventure. Unleash your potential with OPST today. Visit PierceGadget.com or call them at 206-858-8476. Again, that's PierceGadget.com or call them at 206-858-8476. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Phil Shook about fly fishing the Padre Island National Seashore. If you'd like to ask Phil a question, go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com, and fill out that Q&A text box. All right, Phil, let's see if we got... a question came in on the Internet from Phil in Kentucky. Phil asks, is the fishing there now as good as it was when you first began fishing there?
That's a very good question. I have said that I've had the privilege of traveling to a lot of great destinations and writing stories and being hosted at incredible places. But when this seashore is on, it is as exciting as any destination you can go to. And it has been consistent because it is still this wild place. You still, like all of us, we want to plan and hit things right. You're always throwing the dice a little bit. But year after year, you can't just set a date on a calendar, but those migrations and the bird activity and the number of species that are going off is pretty predictable.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, let's dig into the fishing here a bit more. What fish holding features do guides and anglers look for on safaris, you know, down the seashore?
That is key because people, experienced anglers and the guides, can look down a beach and it'll look just kind of monotonous, but they will be able to spot those features that make all the difference in a trip. So anglers look ahead for any irregular patterns in the breaking surf that indicate pockets or dead-end guts. These fish attracting features are subject to the winds, tides, and currents and are constantly changing, disappearing, and reappearing along the beach. And on Padre Island, on your trip down, if the fish are not around the 20-mile marker at the usually dependable little shell and big shell beaches, there's probably something happening further down at the 35-mile marker. At the 30-mile marker is the Coto del Diablo, or Devil's Elbow. This is where the beach makes a dogleg left. It is a stretch of beach that represents the westernmost extent of the Gulf of Mexico. The stretch of beach around the 35-mile marker used to hold the hull of a washed-out shrimp boat where redfish and mangrove snapper would grab any fly that hit the water. On one trip there, I hooked a 27-inch Spanish mackerel that took the fly at a dead stop and headed straight offshore in a sizzling run. As I mentioned to you, a fresh Spanish mackerel taken that same evening to a restaurant and nearby Port Aransas can make for a memorable entree on a seafood platter. At milepost 40, there used to be a wreck, a pyramid iron fuel tank, all that remained of a shrimp boat sunk years ago. This is a good place to begin glassing the surf line looking for tarpon. While the tarpon that pop up within casting range of the first gut are mostly juveniles, schools of six-footers are often seen blasting bait on the surface out near the surf line. At the 45-mile marker is where Sandifer shark fishing clients fought and landed that 820-pound tiger shark one November. At milepost 50 is the remnant of the Nicaragua, a 180-foot-long, 600-ton Mexican coastal steamship. The vessel ran aground in a storm in 1912 under mysterious circumstances. One account passed down through the years is that it was running guns to be used by Pancho Villa in the Mexican Revolution, and it was done in by a government spy. Another version of the story is that it was merely a banana boat that ran aground on a routine run. Just past milepost 60 is the North Jetty in the Mansfield Channel. Here, The safari anglers can take a break for lunch and prospect around the rocks on both the surf and channel side for schools of redfish, rolling tarpon, or a prized Texas snook. On the return 65-mile trip, there are still plenty of stops to make. When the jacks pop up, reds are spotted in the washouts, and ladyfish are blasting bait on the surface.
Are they, when you're with a guide there, I'm assuming the guide provides the transportation.
Correct.
Yeah. And are they glassing the surf from the vehicle and looking for activity or birds and then making a stop, or are you walking the beach for, you know, mile after mile looking for
fish?
Good
question. There's a lot of observing of what is going on, and of course the guide knows the areas that have been good or what to look for, but yes, it's such a long run that there's a lot of observing by everyone on the way down and on the way back, so there's a lot of hunting that goes on. And one thing about this adventure is that the state of alert that you're on, especially when there's a lot of activity, different fish showing up, and a lot of diving birds and activity, you're just in a sense of alert for like 8 straight hours, because the minute you kind of take a bite out of a sandwich, your partner has just caught a 20-inch trout, and you want to get out there and take a shot at it in this little dead-end gut that he's fishing. So, yes, there's a lot of observation. And the guides, of course, know what to look for. But that's what's so great about the fall, because you can see the bird activity, the surface activity, pretty much. You know you're going to check those things out. But it's not always where the bird activity is. It's also these features that might hold that trout of a lifetime. So sometimes you can even see those as you're moving down the beach and you want to quietly get out of the. One of the rules of the guides is that don't slam the door, because they can be, those big trout can are wary of about everything.
Are there other rules of the road?
Well, there are other rules of the road. I guess the guides, you know, don't throw anything on the beach. And, of course, there are speed limits on the beach, like 15 to 25 miles per hour, depending on, it's interesting that the speed limits on the National Seashore are 15 miles per hour from March 1 to Labor Day and 25 miles per hour after Labor Day through the end of February. Four-wheel drive vehicles are required for travel on all but the first 5 miles due to the soft sand and loose shells. Oversized tires inflated to around 25 pounds of pressure help vehicles, you know, gain purchase in the sand. Park rangers also recommend beach travelers come equipped with shovels, jacks, and tow ropes or chains. So there are some common sense rules. The experienced drivers often don't really have to put their vehicles in four-wheel drive. They know how to drive because they can judge what, if you've just had a very high tide and the water is pulled out, it's like a freeway. It's just very hard packed sand. Other times you're grinding it out in four-wheel drive. So that's why it helps to go with an experienced angler that's been down there, or groups that go down, or with a guide.
What is at the end of the road, and why do fly fishers want to get there?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And that is the East Cut there at Port Mansfield. And, of course, any jetted pass serves as an ambush point for game fish, and many fish congregate there. Back in the day, it was a little more user-friendly to get out on those rocks, a little flatter surfaces. They've replaced those giant granite boulder, sharp-edged, and it's very irregular now. And but you used to walk out on the rocks, and there were often schools of redfish making a circle like for hours, and they would come around near the rocks, and you get a shot at them, and that could was a very productive way to catch redfish. And also little tarpon, kind of an ancestral home for tarpon. We have some locals there, the local juvenile tarpon rolling around. So that also the jetty pocket, they're always a good place where the surf meets the jetty. And in recent years, with our snook population coming back, that's a good place to catch a snook. And even over on the channel side, there's a little bay there that sometimes draws a lot of redfish. So it's always a good place to look forward to. It can be very popular there with campers. Sometimes it's, you know, suddenly you're coming into civilization. And so, but even the beachfront in that area is a good place to check out because of that ambush point made by the jetty pass there.
Is that a natural cut or a man-made cut?
No, that's a man-made cut into the All little right. community of Port Mansfield, which has very okay. good flex fishing itself. It's in the middle of the South Texas, the Wild Horse Desert, that little community in big ranch country. So you don't have a lot of development along that. And it's on the Laguna Madre, too. So it's a very popular place for...
I see... yeah, the... So you've got Padre Island, and then after that cut, you've got South Padre Island.
Yes, right. Padre Island continues.
Is there anything going on South Padre Island? Is that...
Yes, that's not a bad place when you're staying at South Padre Island, the resort area there, to come up, head north, and come up and fish the other side. So it offers the same kind of beach opportunities in that little shorter stretch of it.
Is there,
it goes down to the big resort community of South Padre Island.
Is there a road on that, on the South
same,
Padre Island as
same
well?
Same access. There's several access points from a paved highway onto the beach, and then you're on the beach road, very similar to the north access, the North Padre access.
Okay, we've talked about a lot of different species. I can't even remember them all that you listed. But so what do we take down for tackle? What rate, weight rods? What kind of lines, you know, sinking?
Yeah, that's
intermediate,
part of the,
floating?
Yeah, that's what? Part of the fun, I think, is to planning these trips and what you want to target. And we get to think about a lot of different gear, a lot of different bite tippets, class tippets. What rods do we take? Jeff Wolda, I got to hand it to him, has one of the best rod carriers for fly rods. And I think it works for other rods, but it also works great for fly rods. Where three of us had like 9 fly rods and 1 spinning rod on our last trip up it on the rack on his front bumper. So, yes, there's, I would say, 7 to 10 weight rods. Match to reels with smooth drags and at least 150 yards of backing is the general approach that will cover a lot of bases. The 7 or 8 weight is really the workhorse. That's for the ladyfish and Jackson. It will handle about everything. The reason I like to take a 10 weight is that when those big jacks come in and you can have a little larger streamer fly, to cast on that 8 weight with a maybe 40-pound strike tibbet on it. And so that kind of – but usually your workhorse is going to be that 8 weight, which, you know, use a 12 or 15-pound class tibbet will do well for most of the action you're going to find. So 6 to 9 foot leaders.
Yeah, okay, go ahead. Go ahead. Sorry,
6 to 9 foot leaders tapered to 10, 12-pound tippets work well for most of the action. A backup rod with a 40-pound bite tippet for tarpon and coated wire leaders are handy if the Spanish mackerel start getting a little bigger or if you get want a shot at a king mackerel, you'd want a coated wire leader. Otherwise, your 8 weight with like a 12 or 15-pound class tippet will work fine.
What did you, I may have missed this, but did you tell us about what type of lines are we floating?
Yeah, that's a very, I think a uniform sink, a clear line is much better than a floating line.
Like an intermediate line? Clear intermediate?
Yeah, I left that out. A clear intermediate line I find far more usable and effective than a floating. You can easily get by with a floating line, but with the breaking surf, it's going to throw that floating line around. And the clear intermediates have always been my first choice.
And is that a tropical line?
You know, that's a good question. I think as long as it's clear intermediate, I'm not that worried about, you know, whether it's, you know, going to be limp or whether it's best for cold or, but I want it to get down a few feet. So, you know, sometimes these are short casts. You want to get it down a little bit, get some leverage, make a 40 to 60 foot cast. They don't have to be long. Get it down a few feet in the current wave action. And, you know, you can handle your favorite floating line, but I think it makes it a little easier with that intermediate, clear intermediate
right.
line.
Cuts through the waves and gets it down where you
right.
need to be. Sounds like, yeah, yeah. Time to take another quick break. When we come back, we'll dig more into strategies and tactics for catching these fish on the Padre Islands. So hang tight. We'll be right back. Fly Fishers International needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. The organization provides grants to help with the restoration of habitats like Wolf Creek in Idaho and Sands Creek in Delaware County, New York, and funds projects that collect valuable data about fish and their habitats like the Peacock Bass Study in Miami, Florida. FFI serves as a strong advocate for fly fishing in all waters for all fish, to preserve and to promote the arts of fly casting and fly tying, and to help ensure future generations can continue to enjoy these one-of-a-kind experiences. These efforts won't be nearly as effective without your help. If you're not already a member, we invite you to join Fly Fishers International as they work to cultivate conservation, education, and community within the sport of fly fishing. Join Fly Fishers International today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to their website at flyfishersinternational.org. Again, that's flyfishersinternational.org. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Phil Shook about fly fishing Padre Island National Seashore. If you'd like to ask Phil a question, just fill out that form on our homepage, and we'll get it answered here on the show. Okay, Phil, question from Carol Gordon in Florida. She says, do you rely on solunar cables? If not, why not?
Yeah, that's a good question. I always wanted to figure out how to pronounce that, whether it's solunar or solunar. But anyhow, we'll just leave it at that. But no, people rely on those, and I think they are very helpful. Certainly, I'm a believer in the moon and its movements and its effects on fishing. I know a group of friends, fly fishers, light tackle anglers, they're really sharp shooters that live in Corpus Christi, and they like to come down to the East Cut during those fall full moons and new moons, and what we call them tarpon moons, and they can have huge nights jumping big tarpon around that East Cut, and that's certainly where the moon plays a role. So I have friends that look at the solunar tables and get a lot out of them. I often find myself at a place and I'm going to be fishing no matter what the solunar tables say. But I'm certainly all for something that gives you a little bit of an edge.
Okay, okay. Charles in Dutch John City, Utah, wrote this in. He says, I used to camp on both sides of the Port Mansfield Cut and fish from the jetties in October and November. The variety of fish from day to day was so inconsistent, but kept one wondering what's next. I would see all tarpon one day, the next day just jack crevalle. The day after would show me only catfish or shark. Then another day would be massive schools of redfish. One day I caught so many Spanish mackerel that I went through a whole spool of bite wire and had to throw away my shirt. Is it normal to have different species move through like that year-round, or is that a seasonal occurrence for some kind of migrational purpose? Wow, he had some incredible days down there.
No, that's a very interesting question and a very interesting definition of inconsistent. It sounds like he's in a paradise, and that's the way I would also describe. You never know what you're going to get, but that sounds like the kind of action that we were talking about that you have year after year on the seashore. But it sounds like he's going to be prepared for just about anything on his next trip, and that's kind of what happens. Your second trip, you're new trips, so you get a lot better at this. But that's what the that's how exciting the seashore can be. It throws, it's a free-for-all. It can throw a lot at you. And consistency, well, the Northeast, you know, they have, as you know, they have four species there. They have stripers and bluefish and stripers. So that's consistent. I love that. I'm not putting it down, but I like to have all the species, and this free-for-all action is part of the big adventure for me.
Yeah, it was, it's kind of fun. I mean, I remember a day in Belize, and I was out with my guide, and we were out for permit. We just had a tough day. We didn't get anything. And on the way home, back to the island we're on, I said, you know what? You know, we don't really have anything to eat there. The restaurant there is serving a frozen fish. And I said, can we catch some dinner? And so we just started trolling clousers, you know, watch the birds. We picked up mackerel, and we had a feast that night of just a fish. And it was kind of like, a smorgasbord of fish and dinner. Not what we were after that day, but it was a fun time getting back to the island, you know.
Sounds like great fun. Great fun.
Yeah. And, having a put this pile of clean fish and conch on the chef's table, and he went to work, and we had a dinner I'll never forget. But
fabulous, fabulous.
Yeah. So it's nice. It's nice to be able to
have the variety. Yeah,
what Charles is describing sounds like just a heck of a lot of fun. I mean, I'm the kind of fisherman that I just want to catch fish, and if I don't get my permit for the day, that's okay. If I caught a bone fish,
those permit fishermen are focused. We have to. I understand that.
I took my son down to Belize his first time permit fishing, and he got his first permit the first week.
I hate it when that happens.
I know, and my son does that all the time. First time I took him out for tarpon, he caught 120-pound tarpon.
Good for him. Right. Well, he's a chip off the old block.
No, he's not. He's better than I am.
It jumped a generation. Is that what
you're saying? Yeah, I guess. Yeah. Yeah, anyway. Let's see. What else we got here? We talked about kind of reading the water and so forth, rod weights, fly patterns. Yeah.
Flies. Yeah, that's a fun subject.
Yeah. I mean, with all these different fish that we're after, what are you doing for flies?
So there are favorite fly patterns that I have used over the years, kind of the fly pattern of the year. But most saltwater streamers work well on the Padre beachfront. I remember using a fly called a fish skin bug. I think it's still out there in around 1 year. Speckled trout would just about walk out on the beach to hit that fly. And I've tried it since then with kind of mixed results, and then you move on to other flies. A current favorite of mine is the Jim Gray snook fly. It's a fly with a few white hackles and some peacock hurls. I think it kind of evolved out of Florida white bait, just a very good basic fly that I hooked a Jack Crevel on that last trip in October, and it did the job. Over the years, I also have had success with half and halves, glass minnow patterns, grizzly deceivers, Beck's bombers, bay anchovy bendbacks, Bondoro bucktails. The comb sea habit is a great mimic for a finger mullet. The Rhodey flat wings and Abrams September Day mullet imitations are great in that surf. On a trip last month, a friend from Montana fished the entire day with a chartreuse and white clouser deep minnow, and he outfished all of us, landing Jack Crevel, redfish, speckled trout, and ladyfish. So you do want to pick your favorite, and, you know, when crunch time comes and those jacks are running, you want to have the right fly on there, but there's just so many possibilities and part of the fun in deciding what flies that you're going to take with you on that next beach trip.
Yeah, we had a question come in. It's funny because come in while we were talking here on the internet from Jeff Arterbaum, and he's in Las Cruces, New Mexico, and he asks, are generalist fly patterns such as the clouser useful for the multiple species encounter, or is it better to use flies representing specific available foods? So I guess you just answered his question. On a day, a clouser
such a great fly everywhere.
Yeah. I mean, I've caught almost every kind of fish on the Clouser, I think, whether it's freshwater or saltwater, you know.
Absolutely. And it's great
Yeah.
on the seashore.
Now, when you go down there with a guide, because this changes around the world where you go, you know, in some places, like in Florida, you go for tarpon, the guide will have their rods, use their rods, their flies, you know, they're comfortable with that setup. In other places, like in Belize, you got to bring everything because the guides hardly have anything.
Right.
So the guides down here on that fish down there on Padre Island, are you expected to bring your own flies? Sounds like expected to bring your own rods, but what's expected in the way of gear?
I would say that usually, right, that your own equipment is going to fit you the best, and it's part of the fun to bring the flies that you've used other places and expect to do well. There's not that many guides. Jeff Wolda is a great guy. He's an excellent fly fishing guide, but he appreciates his fly fishing clients and likes to learn from them and looks forward to, you know, us bringing our equipment and trying different things. So I would say that's not a situation like in the Florida Keys where you every guide there is an expert and every guide there looks at your fly box and says, uh-uh, there's nothing in there that's going to work. Try this. It's a little different situation on the seashore where you're going to be the one that's the expert. But as I mentioned, it's not that difficult to bring a selection of streamers that are going to work very well in that environment.
Yeah. Do you weight or design your flies specifically to cut through the surf and stay in the strike zone?
Yeah, that's part of the decision. Yes, I like to take some flies with lead eyes and weighted flies, but also I think this is a situation wherever we go, the best casting we do, sometimes it's the casting that's going to help you have a great day, and I always think it's easier to cast a lighter fly. I will cast a weighted fly all day if it's the killer, but I will like that Jim Grace fly I mentioned. It's very light. It doesn't have any lead eyes. And when those jacks are coming through, that'd be a time that you want accuracy, you want leverage in your cast, you want a nice tight loop, and you can cast that lighter fly. So these are the kind of choices you make. You learn to make them, but wait, you know, as I mentioned, my friend with that Clouser Deep Minnow, when we got to those cutouts in the beach and he got that fly down, it was the right fly. So I have a selection, but if I'm talking about casting and certain species that I have to get that cast, this jack is coming through the wave, backlit in a wave, I want to get that fly just right, I might want a lighter fly that I can cast better. But yeah, a selection of flies that will work the water column is a very smart approach.
What about effective casting angles for working cuts and guts and active surf? Is there any
Yeah, the
tactics you?
casting angle.
Yeah.
That's a real good question because you learn those skills fishing the surf because you're going to get hit by even gentle waves are going to kind of pound you, so you've got a balance issue there. You have to manage that fly line that you're stripping out. So there's a lot of skills that are learned quickly, maybe even that one round trip because you. So, for example, the current velocities there on the Padre Island are like 3.9 feet per second. That's just rolling. That's as high as that, but usually just 1 foot per second. So you're out there with waves hitting you with current. And so you kind of learn that on the job. For example, when a wave hits you have to learn to kind of let it hit you sideways. You want to be aware of those waves too, but in between is that flat. You want to cast in that flat area that gives you that long strip and you'll have a fly in the water. Sometimes that is taken care of for you because there are literally ladyfish just about running into you and exploding. So it's basically get the fly in the water.
Are
But
you, do you use a stripping basket?
no, I do not. And I don't think I've ever seen anybody with a stripping basket. Now,
Okay.
stripping baskets are very handy for some people. I don't even use them on the jetties where people would think it's a good way to save your fly lines. I'm just not a big fan of stripping benches. One of the main reasons is I want to see where I'm stepping, whether I'm on the flat or whether I'm walking out in the surf. I want to see where I'm stepping. I think they're very helpful in a lot of situations. You don't see people on the flats, the bonefish flats, using stripping baskets, but
no.
There's certainly situations where they're very handy. You can cast farther. Your casts in the surf are not that long, and they would help you, but the problem is they don't fill up with water, but it just catches on things, and I find it not that helpful, but I'm not putting down stripping baskets because they can be very helpful in some others. Pardon me,
what,
other situations.
What would you say your average cast distance is?
Well, it varies, but it's normally very short cast, and I'm talking 40 feet to 60 feet are going to cover just about everything in that first few steps out there, often that you're already seeing fish. But that doesn't mean a good, well-formed cast, because what happens is you're going to see those Spanish mackerel out there. They're going to be in a distance, and you're going to cheat a little bit. You're going to get out there with a, and become an integral part of the food chain because you want to get your fly into those Spanish mackerel. That's where you want to unload a cast. So there's all sorts of casts, but for the most part, you don't need a long cast. You need a nice little warm, some leverage, because you're being bounced around, but you want to be able to handle that line. Sometimes the current is coming at such an angle that it's hard not to get tangled up in it. I've pretty much gotten hog-tied. I have to walk out on the beach and unravel myself. But that's one of the prices you pay for being in an environment where it's just some of the most exciting fishing you can experience.
Are you sight fishing to single fish, or are you sight fishing to schools of fish, or are you blind casting? What
a little bit
kind of break down the percentage.
All of the above, because some of the bigger fish you see, you're going to spot maybe from the vehicle.
Oh,
or you're
going to
get out and you see a little cutout, a little dead end gut that's even before the first bar, and it's like a little saltwater lake, kind of deep. You can't see the bottom. So you can be sight casting there. There can be big ladyfish and reds cruising through there. Of course, when you've got big blow-ups right on the edge of it's basically just get the fly into the melee. And but, yes, different sizing up the situation. There is sight casting involved, and there, you know, when you say sight casting, sometimes sight casting means just drop it into the blow-ups, and sometimes that means an individual fish. So you get a little bit of everything there, but certainly accuracy, as I mentioned, these sharpshooters from Corpus, there's a certain time of year on all those barrier islands when they know they walk on the edge of the beach, they're not even in the water, and they're looking for those big female trout, that kind of a trout of a lifetime, that are moving up and they're feeding right on the edge of the beach. They're very wary. And that's where you have to be very accurate with your cast, and you need longer leaders, small flies. And so there's an element of all of those, and that's why it's so exciting on the seashore. Challenged to do everything like that.
Two more questions, and then we'll be done here. Stephen in Florida wrote, which of your fly fishing the coast strategies translate well to other subtropical coastal waters? I live in Venice, Florida, and fish the Casperson beaches, Sanibel, Boca Grande, and Fort DeSoto beaches. Any of this carry over to Florida, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. He mentioned Sanibel. That wonderful beach.
Oh, yeah,
Sanibel.
Snook, right?
the snook that come right, they're right in there often with the swimmers, and they're right in that swash zone, and you're kind of standing back and sight casting to them as they come in and out. They're kind of ghost-like. So very many of these skills that you practice there would apply, on other beach fronts. I would say learning those skills in one place will really carry over well if you do the Padre Island adventure.
Okay. Danny from Little Rock, Arkansas says, would you please recommend one or two books to read before making the trip? I'll be there the second week in March.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. That's really a softball that he lobbed up there, because the book that I wrote with Chuck Skates and David Sams on fly fishing the Texas coast, backcountry flats to blue water, is available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. But actually, to really get good information, up-to-date information, I would say contact Jeff Wolda with the Padre Island Light Tackle Adventures. He could, very nice guy, be glad to give you information, timely information on the upcoming season. And he's available again, Padre Island Light Tackle Adventures. But the guidebook, it's out of print, but it's available online, and it kind of also gives the options there in the area. So I would recommend that book. I buy that book myself when it comes up, and you get a pretty good deal on it.
Yeah, we have a link on our homepage there to your book as well.
Oh,
as
excellent.
The other
yeah.
Book for
excellent.
Texas.
Appreciate
as well. So
appreciate
yeah.
That.
So hopefully Danny can find a copy of that. I hope he does. And, well, unfortunately, it's time to wrap things up. Boy, we just went through a wealth of information tonight. But hang with me here, Phil. We're going to do some giveaways, and then we'll call it a night. But give me one. I'm going to do a short break here, and then we'll do our giveaways, and that'll be it. The Bonefish and Tarpon Trust works very hard to safeguard the future of our beloved flats fisheries, from protecting spawning sites threatened by unsustainable fishing pressure to securing historic funding to restore Florida's Everglades and estuaries. Thanks to their members, they've expanded their conservation to the Bahamas, Belize, and Mexico. There's still much more work to be done, and they need your help. With your support, they can ensure that the flats fishery is healthy and sustainable now and for generations to come. Visit btt.org and become a member of the Bonefish and Tarpon Trust today. Again, that's btt.org. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave our website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, "What did you think of this show?" Just click on that link and leave your comments, and we really appreciate it. So now it's time to give away our prizes. The winners for our drawings are randomly selected from the show's registration database. If you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late now, but make sure you do so for our next show so you don't miss out on a chance to win some of these great prizes. If you are one of the lucky winners, we will contact you after the show to collect your information so that we can deliver your prize to you. So first, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International, and to learn more about FFI, go to flyfishersinternational.org, flyfishersinternational.org. Great organization to support. If you don't win, go join. Our winner for that is Kathy Williams in Ohio. Kathy Williams in Ohio. So congratulations, Kathy. I know you'll enjoy your membership. And now we'll give away a one-year membership to Trout Unlimited. And to learn more about Trout Unlimited, go to tu.org, tu.org. And again, another great organization to join and support. Our winner for that is Kenneth Cosette in Texas. Kenneth Cosette in Texas. So congratulations, Kenneth. And I'm sure you'll enjoy your prize as well. Now we'll give away a book courtesy of Stackpole Books. I have a whole bunch of books here. I'm going to send the list out to whoever the winner is, and they'll be able to select the book of their choice from that list. So the question is, and you answer this question on that form on our homepage. So put in your answer, your name, and your location, and if you're the first person to answer the question correctly, then you'll be the winner. And let's just clear my queue here. Yeah, we had some last-minute questions here come in. Let me just rattle these questions off to you, Phil, and you just give these real quick answers. Typical size of the juvenile tarpon you're referring to?
About 3 footers.
Okay. You mentioned 30 mile per hour winds at times. Do the winds typically recede toward the evening?
Yeah, the wind is always your partner down there. I think it just varies so much. I would expect to have to deal with the wind, and if you get a light wind, it's a bonus.
Okay.
But not 30, no, it's workable winds for the most part.
Yeah, and that's usually during the spring.
30 is when you go over to the windsurfing center.
Yeah, okay. If you're on a family vacation, is there fishing opportunities in the Corpus Christi area? This is the Corpus Christi area. Yeah,
multiple,
right?
Multiple. There's night piers, there's jetties to fish off of, there's inlets and beach opportunities, there, and of course the flats fishing. Either walk in or get a flats guide to sight cast of the redfish. Just a great place to have many, many options, and it's a wonderful vacation destination for the whole family.
Okay. Question for the Stackpole book is, what weight rod is the workhorse rod for the Padre Island seashore? What is the weight of the workhorse rod that Phil recommended? Okay, so it takes a second for them to hear us, and we've got, I think, an answer here. You tell me, Phil. My answer is 8 weight.
Bingo.
So Jeffrey Shaney in Denver, you're going to get yourself a Stackpole book. So, Jeffrey, I have your email address here. Thank you for that, and I will send you a list of books and then by email, and then you can pick one out and send your address with that reply, and we'll be all set and get your book out to you. So congratulations, Jeffrey. Thanks for paying attention, and get down there from Denver. Hey, you enjoying that snow today? I got about 8 to 10 inches up here in Bailey, so I know they got some in Denver too. So congrats, Jeffrey, and I hope you enjoy the book you select. All right. Well, Phil, thank you so much for being with us again on the show and sharing all your knowledge. You're just a wealth of knowledge, and it's always fun to pick your brain about these kinds of things. So thank you so much for being on the show tonight with us.
Thank you so much, Roger. I enjoyed our trip down the beach, and I hope you stay warm this winter.
Well, you got me excited about coming down there. I may be knocking on your door one of these days.
No, absolutely. Let me know.
All right. Take care. Hopefully all of you found the podcast archive on our website. If you haven't, just look for the link on the top line menu in the archive. You'll find all of our past shows, over 430 shows now, which you can search by keyword or keyword phrase. Go ahead and explore. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised at what you discover and what you'll learn by listening. Our next broadcast will be on December 17th, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. On that show, I'm going to interview Drew Price, and our show will be Bowfin, Gar, Pike, Trout, and More, Cracking the Code on Lake Champlain's Fly Fishing Giants. So step into one of North America's most diverse and underrated fisheries as we explore the wild, multi-species world of Lake Champlain with expert guide Drew Price. From explosive bowfin and prehistoric long-nosed gar to powerhouse pike, world-class bass, carp, drum, and even salmonoids. Salmonoids for Champlain offers unmatched opportunity for adventurous fly anglers. So be sure to join us. Add this to your upcoming show. There's a link to a calendar on our homepage right under Drew's photograph. Just pick your favorite calendar and add that show so you'll be reminded to show up on December 17th. I'd like to thank Fly Fishers International, Trout Unlimited, Bonefish and Tarpon Trust, Olympic Peninsula Skagit Tactics, the Ugly Bug Fly Shop, and Watermaster for sponsoring our show tonight. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future live broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.